Hazel Kahn in North Fork Works, and I'm sitting with Bob Jester in his house 7 years after he sat with me in my house. And this time things have changed. Welcome, Bob, again, second
time.
Thank
you for having me. I really appreciate it. Good seeing you again.
It's so much I want to hear from you. It was 7 years ago, April the 4th, 2012. And one of the things you mentioned in there, I asked you about your being a chimney sweep, because
yes,
that's how I got to know you.
Right.
You came to my house and cleaned my chimney. And then I said, but you're talking about all this equipment, and you haven't mentioned one piece of equipment, and that's the top hat.
Top hat.
And you said,
you should always wear a top hat, and for two reasons. You keep good luck in it, and it keeps you safe. Now, in all my years of climbing on roofs, whenever I have a brush in my hand, I carry my top hats on my head. And there's been one day where I didn't wear it because it was raining out really hard, and the roof was rather slippery, and it was the only one I've ever fallen from. The one thing in the world that I'm superstitious about is that top hat.
Exactly. I told my wife, I've got one or two little things to do today. I could change the oil in the truck, or there's a little chimney job to do up in Southold. I think I'll go do that. I was wearing the top hat the day of the accident.
Oh, you were.
And I'll never forget it because I was conscious the whole time.
Mm.
And the first fireman that got there that was on the rescue team from Southold, his first question, did you have your hat on?
Really?
And they went and found it. Yeah, I had it on, and it didn't work that day. I went to the house to do the chimney job, and I did something I've never, ever done in 42 years. I took a shortcut. I had the wrong ladder. I knew I had the wrong ladder for how high the house was. So instead of putting the ladder where it should have been because it was too short, I put it on the stones in the driveway. And I got to the top of the ladder, and just as I did, I felt it going over, which put me on top of a concrete slab. And so I broke 19 bones. And, you know, since that day, I've been paralyzed from the waist down. My spine was broken in two places and quite a few ribs. And I could hear the crunching. I knew it was really bad when I hit the ground. And it's funny because I felt like I was falling in slow motion. And the words that went through my mind are, this is going to be a terrible day. The owner came out. Yeah. He heard the commotion. And I said, please call 911 right away and tell them this is serious. I was still conscious enough. You know, I told them I have no feeling from the waist down. Horrible pain. You know, my chest was really, 10 ribs were broken. So I was hurting. I told them, I said, I think we're going to need a helicopter. And he said, it's already on the way. You know, so they knew right away, you know. The interesting thing was, but as the pain got more intense, all of a sudden, I couldn't see anything. All I saw was white. Everything was white, and I don't know what that was. It was the most excruciating pain. And even now, I have terrible pain constantly down my legs and in my back, 24 hours a day, just different degrees. They got me into the helicopter. I've been to probably 100 helicopter landings with the fire department. Mm. I never took the time to think about what that person that was being loaded into the machine really was thinking. Because, you know, we train for things in the fire department. Those people in Southold, they were so good. The rescue squad was just perfect. Everything they did was by the book. But while they were loading me in, for the first time ever, I thought about all that training and all these people giving up their time.
Because they're all volunteers.
All volunteers. And, you know, the pilots flying these helicopters.
They're also volunteers?
No, they're not. That's a dangerous job. There's been so many times where in the middle of the night we'll have a rescue here or something, and they'll come in with those helicopters pitch dark, windy, rainy, you know, bad weather and everything, and still land them and you know, take the people usually off to Stony Brook when it's something really serious. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just appreciate it. I appreciate that more than, you know, people ever could know. You know, I think about all the people in the world that are being threatened with death, you know, that are fighting wars and things like that, and how there are people that would kill other people in a moment's notice. And here all these people are joining together to try to help someone. To some way, that's really, really, it made me feel good. Even though I was in really miserable shape, to know that there were people out there willing to do anything to try to help me. You know, and when we landed at Stony Brook, the same thing. There was a crew right there. They rolled you in. They evaluated you, and they did all kinds of, you know, x-rays and things like that. And so went through the surgery. And of course, I don't remember any of that. It was within an hour, I'd say, of arriving. Mm-hmm. And it was through the whole night until 7 the next morning.
Really?
And then I thought afterwards, my wife told me how much blood they'd use for transfusion and things like that. I said, and here the number of times we give blood and think, oh, I'm giving blood to help somebody out. Whoever gave that blood saved my life, you know, and I'll never thank them. I'll never get a chance to meet them, I'm certain. And I don't know whose blood I've got running through my veins now, you know. But I think about that. Just a week or two ago, South Hold had a blood drive. You know, and people say, oh, I'm going to go and give some blood, and they're going to have spaghetti dinner afterwards or something. Yeah. But the bottom line is they're giving blood that's saving, really, truly saving people's lives. And it's not something you can plan ahead for. It's on the moment, you know. I don't know. I learned to appreciate those type of things more
well,
and more.
And I think the people who donate blood, do you think most people don't realize what they're doing when they give blood? I mean, giving blood, it is blood.
But I've given blood a number of times, and up until, well, a number of years back, I found out I had leukemia. And so they said, no more, you mm-hmm. can't give blood anymore, of course. But up until that time, I'd given blood quite a few times. You know, I used to give blood because I think people would embarrass me if, you know, they'd come and have a blood drive at school and they go, you're not giving blood. And
you get a little sticker or something.
Oh, you get a little sticker, yeah. Maybe originally I did it just because I was a little embarrassed because I hadn't been doing it. When I went to Rusk a week after the surgery at Stony Brook, I went to Rusk in Manhattan for my primary rehab. And what an interesting place that is. Oh, my goodness.
Why?
It's just filled. I was on the ninth floor, and they were all people with spinal cord injuries mm-hmm. or brain injuries or brain cancer. It was so well run. The second day I was there, a group of firemen from Greenport came to give me a helmet with all kinds of well wishes on it, because my helmet, they knew from years ago, I got it in another story, but it was all smashed up. And they brought me a new helmet, you know. It's the first time, I think, in a long time I cried. You know, I turned around and saw these three guys there, standing there with their helmet and their big grins on their faces, you know. And then, you know, there were so many people supporting me. And also, a member of my family stayed with me for the whole 3 weeks I was there, one way or another. They stayed at a hotel and would walk down every day to be with me. Or the facility is so packed with people. I was in a room designed for one, and there were two people, and the man alongside of me, to get me in the wheelchair each morning, they had to put him up in bed and move his bed back 3 or 4 inches mm-hmm. to make a clearance
really?
So I'd get through. My insurance was up in 14 days, and then the hospital said, you've made really, really good progress, and so we're going to give you another week. But the hospital ate that, you know, and in therapy, you have to take painkillers. You have to, because you're so smashed up. I had to have a brace made for the front of me and the back of me because of the spinal cord injury. When they did the surgery, they put two large rods the full length of my vertebrae and 16 bolts. So I'll never be able to bend over mm-hmm. again. Doing the therapy was so difficult and so painful. And they let you pretty much take, within limits, as much painkiller as you wanted. Opioids.
Yeah,
and,
of course. So I
took quite a bit of painkiller. But I noticed as time went on there, I told the girl, I said, I'm really concerned, because it was the first time in my life where I noticed my sense of humor was going away. I wasn't joking around like I used to. And that was always my thing, you know. I always could see light. I tried to not take myself too seriously. And I noticed in that time, all of a sudden, I stopped worrying about other people and started just letting the world be me. I didn't like that at all. I told her, I said, it's not like me to be focusing on myself all the time, but I am. And she said, well, that's natural because of all the things you've been through and everything.
And everybody else is focusing on you,
right,
too. Yeah.
Right. But I said, I think some of it has to do with the pain medication. She said, well, right now you can't get off of it. But she said, you can, in your next rehab facility, tell them you want to reduce the pain medication. But she said, don't do it quickly, because what I did is I actually tried to stop taking it for like 4 hours. And I was really a mess. And it took me like 12 hours to get it back again. You know, there was a lag period between taking the medication and really having an effect on you.
Are there weird things happening to you?
No. The weird things to me were the fact that I wasn't joking around much. And that told me something, because something was chemically...
And that's why you wanted to stop?
I wanted to reduce it, yeah, at least. So when I got to Peconic Landing, that was my next rehab, right. And I was there for a month. I told them that first thing, and they said, we'll help you. Don't worry, we'll work you on that. And they did. And we got to a point where I was taking maybe one-third of what I was taking in the city. But I couldn't get it lower than that. So I decided I was going to make a sincere effort. I was going to use my science skills and try to do an experiment. And one of the experiments I did to try to reduce pain had to do with there was a young man in town here that I've been tutoring for a few years in science, just as a volunteer. He was just interested in science.
You were a science teacher.
Yes.
High school.
He was a little guy in sixth grade, and I was doing 10th grade biology with him. His father did a lot of work on the computer, and through a series of kind of fumbles, his father told me, if you're dealing with pain, there's a company out in California that's doing a lot of work trying to relieve pain using virtual reality. And he said, I'll have them contact you. Well, the people contacted me. The company's name is Applied Virtual Reality. They were a very young company and very young people in it, you could tell. But what they'd been doing is they'd been using virtual reality for young people, particularly children that were going to have an operation or maybe children that were dealing with cancer and its treatments. They were trying to get children focused more on the entertainment of virtual reality and less on the pain. And he said, maybe you want to try this. Well, they contacted me and said, well, we'll send you out everything we've got, and you can try whatever you want. If you want, you can keep it, no charge, or send it back. Just we'd like to know something about if it helps. So right away, I started taking notes and keeping notes on how many opioids, or the dose I was taking every day, and the amount of VR I was using. And it went down and down and down by focusing whenever the pain came. And yesterday it came.
You're still using it?
Yeah. Mm. Yesterday the pain came, and I had a visitor here, and they knew because I start crying. The pain is so bad, I actually still start crying once in a while. And the day before, a friend of mine from the fire department was here, and while he was here, it came, and he said, you're feeling pain? I said, yeah, and he left right away because he knew. It just comes. And it only lasts about 10 or 12 minutes, but it's pretty intense. So I tried this VR, and what I found is I got the opioids down to, I think it was 5 milligrams.
What had it been?
A lot, I don't want to say.
You don't want to say.
So I got it down to this low level, and I contacted the people. Well, they came out, and they did a little video from California.
Yeah.
And I said, you can use that for anything you want.
So anyway, what did they film?
I can give you a copy of it. I'll just email it to you.
Yeah, I do.
I told them, I said, this VR really has helped me. And I said, when I watch the VR and I have the pain come, I can focus myself consciously on what I'm seeing in the virtual reality. The things they gave me originally were little bears shooting bubbles at targets and things like that, because it was designed for children.
Yeah.
But then they also gave me several other adult ones that they hadn't even released to the kids, I don't believe. One was the Wright brothers flying on an airplane. That was an animation, it's true, but it was so realistic. I felt like I was with Orville on the original plane. You'd look down at sheep running across the field and everything. I just love that one. And then they sent me other ones on a visit to Machu Picchu, to England, a visit to Los Angeles, and I love those. There was one called Farm Animals. The first night I put it on, I was sitting right over there in that chair. The Farm Animal one came on. I had a board I keep in front of me to have my dinner on. I had my dinner in front of me, and I had the VR on, and this cow came up to lick me. And as the cow came up to lick me, I pushed him away and took my dinner all across the room. And it was that realistic.
Bob Jester is talking to me about his life since his accident. This is North Fork Works on WPKN Radio.
I told the people from Applied Virtual Reality out in California, I told them, this isn't the be-all and end-all. It's not going to do away with pain. But what it does do is it teaches me ways of concentrating away from the pain. Now, since that time, they put together new programs. They sent me one about 6 months ago, but it was one on meditation. I've tried all these, so many tapes and things like that on meditation and relaxation things, but it didn't do much for me. the one that they did, because it was virtual also, you saw things where crystals were dissolving and trees were eventually blooming and things like that. That one was much better. It taught me to do some of those things when I don't have the VR on, when I don't have the headset on. Now, there's a box over there in the chair right alongside of me that they sent. It's their brand new one, and it's a 21-day program. But these have hand controls and a monitor for your rate of breathing and your blood pressure. Mm. Or heart rate, I'm sorry, heart rate, not blood pressure. Mm. So they're really getting into this. And they've been expanding all over the country. So it's growing. What I told them, as far as virtual reality is concerned and pain remediation or control, they have to just be aware of their audience. When I was at Rusk in Manhattan, what I noticed is that the young people that were in my situation, they had broken spinal cords, they had damage to their brain and things like that, they were really less understanding about pain. They were the ones that were screaming for more pain medication. I mean, really, to the point they wouldn't do anything unless they got more pain medication. Because I think they hadn't experienced much pain in their life. You and I know, just getting older, you get up in the morning and you ache, you know, and you know what pain is, you know, and a constant pain. They didn't. And so they wanted all to go away and feel like they did before. They're starting a VR program at Rusk for pain remediation using VR, actually using applied VR. The younger people, I think they need different programs.
You have to be really engaged in the content.
You have to. And so I could see some of the, when I talked to some of these young people at Rusk in particular, they were interested in skateboarding. That's how they had the accident. Or they were riding a motorcycle.
You use it every day?
No, no. I've been really away from it for quite some time now. Had it all handled. But then the last 2 days, I've had these issues. Yeah, I can feel the rods all the time. And I can twist a certain way in bed. And no pain. And I twist a little to the left or a little to the right and terrible pain. So I know everything's jammed up in there. There's nerves that are, you know, put in places that shouldn't be. I don't know how we're going to deal with that. You know, I'll still use the tricks I use with VR. The other things that help me with pain, strange as it seems, is one of the things I always taught kids in school. Anybody can be nice and be good when things are going well. But when things are really hitting the fan, on the real dark days of life, that's when you define who you really are. And I've told my own children that. So many students and my own children have come back with those words every time I feel a little bit sorry for myself. They'll say, you know, Dad, how you handle the dark days tells who you really are. So I had to try to live up to that a little. Other things that have helped me is sometimes when it's really bad and I just feel like I want to pop an oxy or something, I'll say, okay, let's think of my children, my grandchildren, my sister, my wife, my sister's husband. Of those people, they're the closest ones to me. Who would I rather give this to?
What, the pain?
The pain.
Oh.
And then right away I go, I want it. Give it to me. I can take this, you know. And then I can handle it a little bit better. I just do. When those three firemen came in that day, I said, I'm gonna battle this and I'm going to walk someday. Now, I don't know if I will. I really don't. I can't let them down now. But I told them, I'm going to show people how tough a fireman can be. I came home. I was wondering, how am I ever going to get into the house? And my wife opens the garage door, and there, going alongside the garage and across the back of the garage, is this gigantic, beautiful ramp that they had built. The guys came and built it while I was away. They asked me to give a little talk on chimney fires over in West Hampton. The fire chief went with me. I borrowed a friend's van. It was actually a customer's van. And I put license plates on it and everything, but it was really difficult to get me in there and then get the wheelchair out. And so the fire chief drove me over there. That night he said he got home and he called the captains of the five fire companies in Greenport and said, we're going to buy a van for Bob. And they called me over the firehouse for, they wanted me to help with a kid's project. And I get over there and there's 100 cars in the parking lot. I said, what else is going on here? There must be some training I didn't know about. My wife said, I don't know. And we went in the back of the building, and the chief said, oh, there's a few people that want to see you in the bay number two. So I went into engine bay number two, and there's no fire truck there. There's this beautiful red van. And everybody goes, surprise! And it's the second time I cried. They told me, this is for you. They push a button on the door. The van drops to the ground. A door opens on the side. A ramp drops out. I roll in, put myself alongside the driver's seat and jump in the driver's seat, and it's got hand controls. And I drive myself. Where the passenger seat was, I bring my wheelchair into the other seat.
you can't actually use your legs.
No, but there's controls to your hands. One hand control works the brake, and the other works the gas. And so I can drive. And so my wife doesn't have to take me every day to Peconic Landing. I don't know. They've just done so much. And I said, the number of times we've had things like spaghetti dinners to help out someone in the community that's really, against the wall, or someone that lost their house in a fire or something like that. I'd always go over there and work and never really thought about it until that day when I opened the van. They had my two little grandsons in the back seat. And then the chief came over and said, this is your van.
And then did you understand that it was made for you?
It took several minutes to soak in. It really did. I don't know how I'll ever repay these people.
Well, you've already got a lot of equity with them.
But all these years, when we do things, because I think a lot of times people have no idea what a volunteer fire service does for the community other than fire service. Scout programs to sport programs to running blood drives to running dinners to raise funds. There's a lot that goes into it, a lot of volunteer service that's not part of firefighting.
So what is it about firefighters?
I'm not certain, but they have something special. And it worries me because we're losing so many of them to age, and we're not replacing them with young people.
Why is that?
It's because of the economy, because of society in general. We're just not.
Volunteering in general doesn't have much value.
It has a lot of value.
No, but I mean, it's not perceived as having value.
Exactly. There are just so many pressures. I look at young people and trying to raise a family today where maybe both parents are working. And if you look at the requirements for the fire service now, the training, it's pretty extensive. It really is. And there's updates needed every year. And that's nothing compared to the rescue team. The people in the rescue team are really, really, really special people to me. I'm talking about, emergency rescue, where they go to car crashes and things like that. Little Greenport, we had over 800 calls last year.
Really?
Yes, most of them were for rescue. And, we have a more of a senior population here, with the population out here is getting older. And so there are many, many more rescue calls.
And a rescue calls is just from car accidents?
Car accident, could be a heart attack, could be a stroke. A lot of them are things like strokes, heart attacks. And I look at the population of our rescue teams, and the age is going up and up.
They're
going to
need rescuing.
And so it's getting harder and harder at 2 o'clock in the morning. Because realize, if there's a rescue call, I don't care if it's someone stubbed their toe or has a nosebleed. When you come back, there's an hour's worth of paperwork. Mm. And if there isn't an hour's worth of paperwork, if there's a drop of blood on the bottom of the bus, bottom of the rescue squad vehicle, that blood's got to be cleaned up and everything has to be put away just a certain way. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of responsibility. At one time in my company, my wife was involved. She was in both rescue and in the fire service. My daughter was a member and my oldest son was a member. My oldest daughter moved away into the city. She's no longer a volunteer. My son moved to Southold. He is holding down two jobs trying to keep things going. He could never go back for fire school. And my wife gave it up because she decided she wasn't going to keep doing this. I've tried to stress that to my family, but I realize, what they are dealing with as far as financial stresses are concerned. Yeah. I'd hate to see the fire service out here become paid. When you're a paid fire department, I feel there's a difference in the pride of your equipment. If you're a paid fire department, it's much more difficult to find time to run blood drives or to raise funds for someone or to conduct a program that people do as volunteers. The paid firemen are just as dedicated, are just as attached as volunteers, if not more. I don't know what it is. I think there's a lot of good in people. We can't tap into it sometime. In Greenport, anyway, we've got a tremendous number of people of Hispanics that could, I think, really and truly, be a lot more involved in the community. And I wish they would. We had a local minister, that speaks Spanish very well, and he brought several people over to the firehouse to meet us and come to dinner. Mm-hmm. But until we really, really, really accept them in the population, I don't think it's going to happen.
The resistance is not from them, it's from us?
Maybe a little, yeah. Mm. It's just a great human resource that we're not tapping in.
A lot of them are just too frightened to come out.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, they just don't feel safe enough. Green card people get arrested and deported.
Hopefully this will change soon.
Well, we've got to change it.
Well, as far as being a scientist is concerned, right now I consider what I'm doing a science experiment. I really do. I've contacted two doctors from Sweden. There's an electrical stimulator they implant in the back of some people with this kind of pain, and it deadens the pain. What they've done is they've taken that same stimulator, put it down below the injury, and changed the frequency and the intensity of the pulses of electricity that are sent more to simulate a natural impulse that you need to move legs and things like that. They've tried to simulate that same type of impulse. And of the three people, two of them right now are walking with walkers. One is walking on a treadmill with no support, no hands holding anything, walking with his legs. They're coming to this country within the next several months. I think they're going to look me up. The only thing I didn't tell them was my age, because I think that would disqualify me. And the other thing was my injury, it's listed as a T12 injury. They do injuries down as far as T10. They told me from 1 to 4 years from now, they'll be working on T12. And they said, I'm on the top of their list. I'm hopeful for that. I try to read all I can on what they're doing with stem cells, regenerate nerve tissue. And I'm just interested in nerve regeneration itself, which is very, very limited. Anyway, I read everything I can as far as that's concerned. But I consider this an experiment. And the only reason now that I'm going to Peconic Landing every day at 7:30 every morning, 5 days a week, and sometimes 6 days a week, depending on what therapist is on Saturdays. And first thing I do is I get on a stepping machine. My arms work my legs. I do 10,000 steps on the stepping machine. It used to take me 2 hours to do it. Now it takes about an hour and 31 minutes. Mm. Then I go on to another machine just to lift weights to keep my arms in shape. And I do that for about 20 minutes. And then I get into a standing box and I stand for 1 to 2 hours. That holds me up in an upright position just to keep pressure on all the joints and everything. And I have little exercises that I purposely do while I'm in that just to try to fire off the muscles right now that aren't firing. And then after that, I get into the wheelchair. I try never to call it my wheelchair. Always try to call it the wheelchair. And the ladies at Peconic Landing, they're funny because the other day one of them said, I'll get your wheelchair. And she goes, I mean, I'll get the wheelchair. You know, they know it really upsets me to say my. But anyway, I get in the wheelchair and I do little exercises with my feet, doing different patterns on the floor. And I do that for about an hour. You can see I'm getting movement here. And so I'll get here and I'll go, I'm going to put this on your foot, my foot, your foot, my foot, your foot, my foot. Yeah.
That's a lot that you're moving it.
Yeah, and I can go sideways. I want to be able to drive a car someday, really, with my feet again. This is 32 months of exercise. This has been progressive, but I feel it's probably getting a little bit better by about maybe a millimeter every 2 weeks. That's what I'm thinking, about a millimeter every 2 weeks.
Are you getting a pain now?
Yep.
Okay.
Just a little.
I'm going to go.
Just a little. That's good.
Okay, all right.
It keeps my mind off it.
Yeah. Well, that's what the virtual reality does, too.
It does. It
keeps your mind off it, and it trains your mind at the same time.
It trains my mind to go to other places, you know, and let the pain be secondary and what I'm looking at or thinking about primary. And that's, I think, what it really all comes down to. The pain's still there, but it's become secondary, and you're focusing away from it. I don't care what anybody says. When you go through things like that, you go through a dark time. I mean, really a dark time. And hopefully, you know, you have the support to get through it. You think about it, most things in life are like an aircraft carrier turning. You know, they're gradual changes.
Yeah.
Those type of changes your body's not designed for. They're like changing in a jet ski instead of an aircraft carrier.
No.
It's difficult to adapt to it.
So thank you very much then, Bob.
You've been listening to Bob Jester on North Fork Works talking about his life after a terrible accident. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of each month at 7:30 p.m. All North Fork Works programs are available as podcasts and posted on hazelkahn.com. North Fork Works is produced by Tony Ernst.